Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Buddham namang sanghang namasami. So tonight I want to start by telling you a little story of my time when I was training in Japan. So Linda, if you have any trouble hearing me, you just raise your hand. Thank you. And maybe go from there into talking about right intention. And at least one of you has already heard this story, so hopefully I make it worth hearing again. So as I think everybody here knows, I was first ordained in the Soto Zen tradition, and I ordained at a temple in a little town called Obama in Japan on the what they call the back side of the main island, so on the strait between China and Korea and Japan, on that side of the water. And there's a temple called Hoshinji, and the Zen master who ordained me, his name is Sekke Harada, and his title is Roshi, means old teacher or venerable. Yeah. At Harada Roshi's temple was, a little that I know at the time that I ordained, was one of 27 training temples out of thousands of Zen temples in Japan. And so what that means is that there are little sub-temples that go, that we were sort of responsible for. And 26 of them, or 28 of them, I forget how many. And so in the fall, we would go out to these little rural Japanese neighborhoods where our sub-temples were, and we would do alms collection rounds. In Japanese, the word for that is takuhatsu. Takuhatsu, we go out on begging rounds. And it was, the monastics, all of us, we kind of considered it like the dessert of the year. It was the nicest period of the year because it's fall in Japan, which means a beautiful, more or less beautiful weather, and we would get in the monastery van and go, you know, big groups of us, six or eight of us at a time, out to these little rural communities and pack our little bento lunch with us and the whole thing. So it was a nice chance. And this was like 5 or 6 days a week, actually, that during this time of the year that we would be out doing begging rounds. And it was one of the main forms of training at Hoshinji. We had three main activities at Hoshinji. One was the begging rounds. One was sitting intensive sesshins. So we did seven or so intensive sitting periods during the course of the year. And people would come from all over the world to sit with Roshi at those intensives. And we did a lot of work. That was also a big part of the training there. Working in the mosque garden and in the cemetery, we were responsible for this huge cemetery that covered two hillsides behind our temples, and so on. But in any event, so we were out on begging rounds this one particular day, and I had this bell. So I'll hold it up so you can see it. And as you can see, it's kind of loud. Like, you can really hear us coming. This is the actual bell, right? And this is, it's supposed to be loud because we're walking down the street. And in this particular time of year, we would go door to door and chant the Heart Sutra in Japanese. Kanji, Zago, Satsuki, Ojin, Nanyo, Harami, Tari. Get pretty good at doing it fast. So we went into this neighborhood, and typically we'd kind of split up. Even though there were big groups of us, we would each be given a couple of blocks, and then we'd kind of do our section, and then we'd reunite, and then we'd go to the next section like that to make sure that we covered every single house, except for houses that had the Shinto, a little Shinto marker on the house, and then we didn't bother those folks because they were doing some other tradition. They were involved with some other tradition. And so there I was walking along by myself, ring my bell, in my totally traditional gear. In order to go on begging rounds, you get dressed up in arguably like the most medieval form of Soto Zen gear. So you hike up your robe with your belts in certain ways, such that your kimono and your outer robe are higher, like just below the knee, so that you don't get it, drag it in the snow. Certainly what it's for, not to drag it in the snow and the mud. And you wear one of those big bamboo hats that everybody recognizes, yeah. And this bag around the neck, which is where the actual donations go. This kind of canvas bag that has in three big bold letters, Ho Shin Ji, the characters for your temple, so people know who you are and where you're from. And these straw sandals that we literally made by hand. So we thankfully had the benefit of making them with plastic rope instead of regular old straw ropes. And they were a tiny bit thicker, but they're still, if you can imagine, like we'd be walking around in all sorts of weather with like thin cotton socks and snowstorms and rain and sleet or whatever kind of weather it was. And these hand woven sandals. It's pretty medieval. So I'm walking along, I'm by myself, I'm ringing my bell, and I walk up to this house. So in this neighborhood, it was a relatively typical Japanese neighborhood, a lot of small houses, like prefab style houses actually, in this part of Japan. And I walk up and I notice as I'm walking up that this small little pickup truck that's in the driveway feels warm still. Like there's some heat coming off the truck. And I think, oh, that's great. This person probably just arrived. It's a good time to catch them, you know, and maybe they'll come to the door and make a little offering. So I walk up to the door, I'm ringing the bell. I get to the door and I start chanting. And this man opens the door. And he is standing there. And, you know, the part of the etiquette is, as we do when we do begging rounds in the Theravada, you don't stare at people who are about to give you an offering, right? You look down at your bowl or you kind of are humble about being there, awaiting to see if this person would like to make an offering for you or not. And they often don't come to the door if they're not going to. But he opens the door and he stands there for a really long time. Because they know, usually, typically, you know, they've lived in, most people in Japan have lived in the same neighborhood for a long time, for generations. That if you give the donation, then I stop chanting the Heart Sutra and I give the blessing and I go away. But there I am and I'm chanting and I'm ringing the bell and he's just letting me go on. But he's not actually, I can't really tell what's happening with this gentleman, right? He's kind of standing in the door and not making any indications of making an offering, but also not making an indication of just closing the door. And I notice while I'm standing there that he has on this really funky kind of belt. But I don't, you know, okay. Because I'm looking down, so I notice that he has on this monkey belt. Okay. And finally, as I get very close to the end of the sutta, he walks away and he leaves the door open. So again, I'm sort of like, well, I guess this means that he's going to get a little, you know, some coins or something to give me, which would be the typical thing to make the offering. So he comes back And he gives me a couple of 100 yen coins, which is very typical offering. A couple, literally at that point in time, about $2, $2 US. And he starts to close the door immediately, which is like, in Japanese terms, incredibly rude. Like, I still haven't even given him the little blessing chant that goes with the donation that he made. And he's like trying to close the door. So I kind of jump in and start chanting the blessing chant, and he leaves the door open long enough for me to do that. And then he closes it quickly behind me. And I kind of say, well, you know, not all that unusual, right? So Japan is a Buddhist country. It was one of the things that was really, really wonderful about living over there, is that it is primarily dominant. Buddhism is the dominant tradition, and Zen actually is one of the dominant traditions in Japan. And so that also means, because it's been there for centuries, that it's become fossilized in certain ways, and some people have very, you know, skeptical or negative perspectives on the tradition, even though their families have been involved with it, you know, and their people are associated with our cemeteries and so on. So I didn't think anything of it. You know, I thought, oh, maybe he's not thrilled about it, but he decided in the end to make an offering. Great. And as I start to walk back down the driveway, I glance into the back of the pickup truck. And there's a deer in the back of the truck with a bullet wound in its head. Dead deer lying in the back of the truck. Like, still warm almost. You know what I mean? Mm. Like, I could, it seemed to me that when I looked in the eyes of the deer, I could still see the startle of the encounter with this man who had killed this being. And it's beautiful, right? I don't know if some of you saw the deer that died here in the meadow last year during our winter retreat. When they're first dead, they're stunningly beautiful. They, you know, they don't start to decompose right away. So you actually see them close up. Their beautiful fur and the shiny, shiny eyes and little long eyelashes. And I also was startled, like, wow, what just happened there, you know? And I flash back to, as we had driven up to this neighborhood, there were these big signs in both English and Japanese that about fines, big fines for hunting. And it very specifically said, there's no hunting in this area. You know, the fines are multiple thousands of yen for hunting in this area. And I thought, and that's pretty unusual. It's not like you see that all over the place. That was kind of unusual. But since we weren't coming for hunting, I really hadn't paid attention to it. Until that moment, when I saw that deer in the back of the truck. And the blood started spilling out the tailgate and onto the driveway as I walked away. So this man's karma worked very quickly in this case. That's how I understand it. He took the life of this being, and then showed up at his doorstep and gave him the opportunity to make an offering, to do something wholesome. you know, there's that verse in the Dhammapada that says, I'm using Gil Bronsdale's translation, Dhammadija Bronsdale's translation of the Dhammapada, that says, one who recovers from an evil deed by doing something wholesome illuminates the world like the moon freed from the clouds. So I suspect that that's something of what was going through his mind as he was standing there on the doorstep. Right? Maybe he typically would not be the person who would give an offering. And that belt was his bullet belt. It was all the bullets were gone. So I realized later that that's what that was. So monastics give people the opportunity in their lives to do something wholesome, whether it's through giving, or whether it's through supporting in other ways, or whether it's through practice, or whether it's through bringing others to practice. It's not that I'm a special person, or that deer was a special deer, or that he was a special man, or a particularly evil man. It is the expression of the Dharma showing up on his doorstep in that moment. That's what I was, the expression of the Dharma showing up on his doorstep at that moment and giving him a karmic opportunity to start turning it around. Just by accident. I had no idea that that's what was happening even until I saw that deer in the truck. Mm-hmm. And it's true all the time. It's true just even coming into contact. I think all of you are here in part because you know that. I think it's part of the Buddha's brilliance that he set up the tradition in this way. It happens when we go Ahimsa Naya into town, into Placerville, to the farmer's market. The farmer's market starts on May 4th this year, and I'm looking forward to going in again. Because time and again, what happens is that people encounter this archetype, and something in them responds. They don't know our names. They don't know where we live. They don't know what these clothes mean, or what tradition we're following, or what we do in our meditation, and they frankly don't care. But something in them is moved to make this act of giving. And by doing that, they get to draw some benefit that they may not even understand or know about. And that's okay too. That's totally fine. So that's part of what it means to be in the robes, and that's part of what it means for you all to support people who are in the robes. But I want to take it a step further, and I want to say that opportunity is always there. That opportunity is actually there in every single moment. We monastics make it more obvious for you, for everyone. For ourselves, and indeed, for ourselves too. We make it more obvious. But the fact is that that opportunity is always there. And a large part of what we do in practice is to remind ourselves that that's so, to remind ourselves of our intention. So like at the beginning of the Metta Sutta, we say, this is what should be done by one who is skilled in goodness. And then we list it out. This is what should be done. So we're not only doing a beneficial activity in that moment of chanting the sutta, but we're reminding ourselves and inclining the mind toward that. So that in the moments of making a decision about whether you're going to swerve to avoid the squirrel on the road, or whether you're going to speak harshly to that person who is speaking harshly to you, or whatever other opportunity you get in the course of a day, that the mind will already be inclined toward the wholesome. As best you can. No matter what kind of metta you're doing, for example, I would say all of the Brahma Viharas, but certainly Shannon and I had a little bit of this conversation before we went into winter retreat. Whether you're doing the radiating form of the metta, or you're doing the chanting the Metta Sutta, or you're reciting the verses, may all beings be well, may I be well, may my family be well, my teachers be well, the people I find difficult be well. All of those kinds of activities are in part for the purpose of inclining the mind so that you can respond to those opportunities that present themselves every day of your life. And just as we said in the Highest Blessing Sutta that we chanted today, so the three classical forms that the Buddha gave when he described the Noble Eightfold Path, the three classical forms of right intention are the opposites of the three poisons or the defilements. So the intention to renunciation, the intention to non-ill will, and then the intention for harmlessness. Right. So renunciation for most folks means something like realizing that the material world is not going to solve your problem. That's real renunciation. That you don't need to hoard material things or wealth or titles or power. Because that's not going to resolve dukkha. None of that is going to resolve dukkha. And similarly, this translation of non-ill will, I really appreciate that, because sometimes it gets translated as goodwill or love or something like that. And I have to say, there's a whole spectrum of things that are non-ill will, including just being neutral towards someone. Sometimes that's a big accomplishment. If you can't muster the loving kindness, at least you can find a neutral spot and fulfill your intention to non-ill will. And then the intention to harmlessness. I don't know why this man is shooting deer. Maybe he's eating it. Not sure. But I do know that part of the teaching, the way that the Buddha taught about karma is that there are many factors at play into the karma consequence of something like that. And if by my standing on his doorstep he decided to have some remorse for killing that being, that would actually help the situation. It would actually mitigate the karma consequence of that action. or if it just made him start to think about harmlessness at some point in his life. So these are the kinds of intentions that we are inclining to by our practice. And it's a broad field. It's a big opportunity this lifetime. And so I appreciate also the Buddha being clear that even when we do something that goes against that intention, the phrase sometimes that comes up in Christian circles is, God allows U-turns.
I'm sorry, say again.
God allows U-turns. And I think probably the Buddhist equivalent would be something like karma enables U-turns all the time, at any time. Right? That's how it works. It's that unfolding. So the Buddha said, it's like salt, right? Doing a harmful deed is like putting salt in water. If you put salt in a small glass of water, a lot of salt in a small glass of water, it's going to be impossible to drink the water. If you put the same amount of salt in a big barrel of water, right, in a big barrel of good deeds, then it will have less of an impact on the karmic stream. So in that way, it's a very forgiving teaching. That we don't have to feel trapped by the mistakes that we've made. So I invite you to think about these opportunities that you have in your life. When you leave the monastery, particularly some of you, maybe are going on to other things soon. And to remember that your practice has that benefit. That's one of the ways I think of it sometimes as, particularly in early Buddhist tradition or in some of the more devotional traditions, there's the saying that the Dhamma is a protection. And actually, this is one of the ways that the Dhamma is a protection. When we incline the mind, when we begin to know, to take up the truth of the opportunity that we have in this lifetime, we are protecting ourselves from our own delusion. We are protected from the delusion of creating harm. That's why harmlessness is the opposite of that defilement of delusion. So again, I hope you take up that opportunity. Every chance you get.
Thank you. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu.
Thank you. Thanks to the Buddha. And to my master, and to many, many, many beings. Make it all possible.